And once again he brought Gaveston home, and heaped upon him all the riches and titles of which the barons had deprived him. The lords saw, now, that there was nothing for it but to put the favourite to death. They could have done so, legally, according to the terms of his banishment. But they did so, I am sorry to say, in a shabby manner. Led by the Earl of Lancaster, the King of TMS cousin, they first of all attacked the King and Gaveston at Newcastle. They had time to escape by sea, and the mean King, having his precious Gaveston with him, was quite content to leave his lovely wife behind. When they were comparatively safe, they separated. The King went to York to collect a force of soldiers, and the favourite shut himself up, in the meantime, in Scarborough Castle overlooking the sea. This was what the barons wanted. They knew that the castle could not hold out, they attacked it, and made Gaveston surrender. He delivered himself up to the Earl of Pembroke, that lord whom he had called the Duke on the Earl of TMS, pledging his faith and knightly word, that no harm should happen to him and no violence be done him. Now, it was agreed with Gaveston that he should be taken to the castle of Wallingford, and the kept in honourable custody. They travelled as far as Diddington, near Banbury, where, in the castle of that place, they stopped for a night to rest. Whether the Earl of Pembroke left his prisoner there, knowing what would happen, or really left him thinking no harm, and only going, as he pretended, to visit his wife, the Countess, who was in the neighbourhood, is no great matter now. In any case, he was bound as an honourable gentleman to protect his prisoner, and he did not do it. In the morning, while the favourite was yet in bed, he was required to dress himself and come down into the courtyard. He did so without any mistrust, but started and turned pale when he found it full of strange armed men. "I think you know me?" "ATM," said their leader, also armed from head to foot. "I am the Black Dog of Arden." "ATM," the time was come when Piers Gaveston was to feel the Black Dog TMS teeth indeed. They set him on a mule, and carried him, in mock state and with military music, to the Black Dog TMS kennel Warwick Castle, where a hasty council, composed of some great noblemen, considered what should be done with him. Some were for sparing him, but one loud voice, ere it was the Black Dog TMS bark, I dare say, sounded through the castle hall, uttering these words, "You have the fox in your power. Let him go now, and you must hunt him again." ATM, they sentenced him to death. He threw himself at the feet of the Earl of Lancaster, the old hog, but the old hog was as savage as the dog. He was taken out upon the pleasant road, leading from Warwick to Coventry, where the beautiful River Avon, by which, long afterwards, William Shakespeare was born and now lies buried, sparkled in the bright landscape of the beautiful May Day, and there they struck off his wretched head, and stained the dust with his blood. When the king heard of this black deed, in his grief and rage he denounced relentless war against his barons, and both sides were in arms for half a year. But, it then became necessary for them to join their forces against Bruce, who had used the time well while they were divided, and had now a great power in Scotland. Intelligence was brought that Bruce was then besieging Stirling Castle, and that the governor had been obliged to pledge himself to surrender it, unless he should be relieved before a certain day. Hereupon, the king ordered the nobles and their fighting men to meet him at Berwick, but, the nobles cared so little for the king, and so neglected the summons, and lost time, that only on the day before that appointed for the surrender, did the king find himself at Stirling, and even then with a smaller force than he had expected. However, he had, altogether, 100,000 men, and Bruce had not more than 40,000, but, Bruce's TMS army was strongly posted in three square columns, on the ground lying between the burn or brook of Bannock and the walls of Stirling Castle. On the very evening, when the king came up, Bruce did a brave act that encouraged his men. He was seen by a certain Henry de Bon, an English knight, riding about before his army on a little horse, with a light battle axe in his hand, and a crown of gold on his head. This English knight, who was mounted on a strong war horse, cased in steel, strongly armed, and able, as he thought, to overthrow Bruce by crushing him with his mere weight, set spurs to his great charger, rode on him, and made a thrust at him with his heavy spear. Bruce parried the thrust, and with one blow of his battle axe split his skull. The Scottish men did not forget this. Next day when the battle raged, Randolph, Bruce Etienne's valiant nephew, rode, with the small body of men he commanded, into such a host of the English, all shining in polished armour in the sunlight, that they seemed to be swallowed up and lost, as if they had plunged into the sea. But, they fought so well, and did such dreadful execution, that the English staggered. Then came Bruce himself upon them, with all the rest of his army. While they were thus hard pressed and amazed, there appeared upon the hills what they supposed to be a new Scottish army, but what were really only the camp followers, in number 15,000, whom Bruce had taught to show themselves at that place and time. The Earl of Gloucester, commanding the English horse, made a last rush to change the fortune of the day, but Bruce, like Jack the Giant Killer in the story, had had pits dug in the ground, and covered over with turfs and stakes. Into these, as they gave way beneath the weight of the horses, riders and horses rolled by hundreds. The English were completely routed, all their treasure, stores, and engines, were taken by the Scottish men, so many wagons and other wheeled vehicles were seized, that it is related that they would have reached, if they had been drawn out in a line, 180 miles. The fortunes of Scotland were, for the time, completely changed, and never was a battle won, more famous upon Scottish ground, than this great battle of Bannockburn. Plague and famine succeeded in England, and still the powerless king and his disdainful lords were always in contention. Some of the turbulent chiefs of Ireland made proposals to Bruce, to accept the rule of that country. He sent his brother Edward to them, who was crowned King of Ireland. He afterwards went himself to help his brother in his Irish wars, but his brother was defeated in the end and killed. Robert Bruce, returning to Scotland, still increased his strength there. As the King Otm's ruin had begun in a favourite, so it seemed likely to end in one. He was too poor a creature to rely at all upon himself, and his new favourite was one Hugh Le Despenser, the son of a gentleman of ancient family. Hugh was handsome and brave, but he was the favourite of a weak king, whom no man cared a rush for, and that was a dangerous place to hold. The nobles leagued against him, because the king liked him, and they lay in wait, both for his ruin and his father Etienne's. Now, the king had married him to the daughter of the late Earl of Gloucester, and had given both him and his father great possessions in Wales. In their endeavours to extend these, they gave violent offence to an angry Welsh gentleman, named John de Mowbray, and to divers other angry Welsh gentlemen, who resorted to arms, took their castles, and seized their estates. The Earl of Lancaster had first placed the favourite, who was a poor relation of his own, at court, and he considered his own dignity offended by the preference he received and the honours he acquired, so he, and the barons who were his friends, joined the Welshmen, marched on London, and sent a message to the king demanding to have the favourite and his father banished. At first, the king unaccountably took it into his head to be spirited, and to send them a bold reply, but when they quartered themselves around Holborn and Clerkenwell, and went down, armed, to the Parliament at Westminster, he gave way, and complied with their demands. His turn of triumph came sooner than he expected. It arose out of an accidental circumstance. The beautiful queen, happening to be travelling, came one night to one of the royal castles, and demanded to be lodged and entertained there until morning. The governor of this castle, who was one of the enraged lords, was away, and in his absence, his wife refused admission to the queen. A scuffle took place among the common men on either side, and some of the royal attendants were killed. The people, who cared nothing for the king, were very angry that their beautiful queen should be thus rudely treated in her own dominions, and the king, taking advantage of this feeling, besieged the castle, took it, and then called the two Despensers home. Upon this, the Confederate lords and the Welshmen went over to Bruce. The king encountered them at Boro Bridge, gained the victory, and took a number of distinguished prisoners, among them, the Earl of Lancaster, now an old man, upon whose destruction he was resolved. This earl was taken to his own castle of Pontefract, and the tried and found guilty by an unfair court appointed for the purpose. He was not even allowed to speak in his own defence. He was insulted, pelted, mounted on a starved pony without saddle or bridle, carried out, and beheaded. 28 knights were hanged, drawn, and quartered. When the king had dispatched this bloody work, and had made a fresh and a long truce with Bruce, he took the Despensers into greater favour than ever, and made the father Earl of Winchester. One prisoner, and an important one, who was taken at Boroughbridge, made his escape, however, and turned the tide against the king. This was Roger Mortimer, always resolutely opposed to him, who was sentenced to death, and placed for safe custody in the Tower of London. He treated his guards to a quantity of wine into which he had put a sleeping potion, and, when they were insensible, broke out of his dungeon, got into a kitchen, climbed up the chimney, let himself down from the roof of the building with a rope ladder, passed the sentries, got down to the river, and made away in a boat to where servants and horses were waiting for him. He finally escaped to France, where Charles le Bel, the brother of the beautiful queen, was king. Charles sought to quarrel with the King of England, on pretense of his not having come to do him homage at his coronation. It was proposed that the beautiful queen should go over to arrange the dispute. She went, and wrote home to the king, that as he was sick and could not come to France himself, perhaps it would be better to send over the young prince, their son, who was only 12 years old, who could do homage to her brother in his stead, and in whose company she would immediately return. The king sent him, but both he and the queen remained at the French court, and Roger Mortimer became the queen Etienne's lover. When the king wrote, again and again, to the queen to come home, she did not reply that she despised him too much to live with him any more, which was the truth, but said she was afraid of the two Despensers. In short, her design was to overthrow the favoritus Etienne's power, and the king Etienne's power, such as it was, and invade England. Having obtained the French force of 2,000 men, and being joined by all the English exiles then in France, she landed, within a year, at Orewell, in Suffolk, where she was immediately joined by the Earls of Kent and Norfolk, the King Otm's two brothers, by other powerful noblemen, and lastly, by the first English general who was dispatched to check her, who went over to her with all his men. The people of London, receiving these tidings, would do nothing for the king, but broke open the tower, let out all his prisoners, and threw up their caps and hurrahed for the beautiful queen. The king, with his two favourites, fled to Bristol, where he left old Despenser in charge of the town and castle, while he went on with the son to Wales. The Bristol men being opposed to the king, and it being impossible to hold the town with enemies everywhere within the walls, Despenser yielded it up on the third day, and was instantly brought to trial for having traitorously influenced what was called the King at Etienne's mind at Mad, though I doubt if the king ever had any. He was a venerable old man, upwards of 90 years of age, but his age gained no respect or mercy. He was hanged, torn open while he was yet alive, cut up into pieces, and thrown to the dogs. His son was soon taken, tried at Hereford before the same judge on a long series of foolish charges, found guilty, and hanged upon a gallows 50 feet high, with a chaplet of nettles round his head. His poor old father and he were innocent enough of any worse crimes than the crime of having been friends of a king, on whom, as a mere man, they would never have deigned to cast a favourable look. It is a bad crime, I know, and leads to worse, but, many lords and gentlemen I even think some ladies, too, if I recollect right have committed it in England, who have neither been given to the dogs, nor hanged up 50 feet high. The wretched king was running here and there, all this time, and never getting anywhere in particular, until he gave himself up, and was taken off to Kenilworth Castle. When he was safely lodged there, the queen went to London and met the Parliament. And the Bishop of Hereford, who was the most skilful of her friends, said, what was to be done now? Here was an imbecile, indolent, miserable king upon the throne. Wouldn't it be better to take him off, and put his son there instead? I don't yet empty know whether the queen really pitied him at this pass, but she began to cry. So, the bishop said, "Well, my lords and gentlemen, what do you think, upon the whole, of sending down to Kenilworth, and seeing if his majesty, God bless him, and forbid we should depose him, won't TMT resign?" My lords and gentlemen thought it a good notion, so a deputation of them went down to Kenilworth, and there the king came into the great hall of the castle, commonly dressed in a poor black gown, and when he saw a certain bishop among them, fell down, poor feeble-headed man, and made a wretched spectacle of himself. Somebody lifted him up, and then Sir William Trussell, the Speaker of the House of Commons, almost frightened him to death by making him a tremendous speech to the effect that he was no longer a king, and that everybody renounced allegiance to him. After which, Sir Thomas Blunt, the steward of the household, nearly finished him, by coming forward and breaking his white wonder, which was a ceremony only performed at a king at TMS death. Being asked in this pressing manner what he thought of resigning, the king said he thought it was the best thing he could do. So, he did it, and they proclaimed his son next day. I wish I could close his history by saying that he lived a harmless life in the castle and the castle gardens at Kenilworth, many years, so that he had a favorite, and plenty to eat and drink, and, having that, wanted nothing. But he was shamefully humiliated. He was outraged, and slighted, and had dirty water from ditches given him to shave with, and wept and said he would have clean warm water, and was altogether very miserable. He was moved from this castle to that castle, and from that castle to the other castle, because this lord or that lord, or the other lord, was too kind to him, until at last he came to Berkeley Castle, near the River Severn, where, the Lord Berkeley being then ill and absent, he fell into the hands of two black ruffians, called Thomas Gorn and William Ogle. One night, it was the night of September the 21st, 1327, a dreadful screams were heard, by the startled people in the neighbouring town, ringing through the thick walls of the castle, and the dark, deep night, and they said, as they were thus horribly awakened from their sleep, "May heaven be merciful to the king, for those cries forebode that no good is being done to him in his dismal prison." A.T.M. Next morning he was dead, and not bruised, or stabbed, or marked upon the body, but much distorted in the face, and it was whispered afterwards, that those two villains, Gorn and Ogle, had burnt up his inside with a red-hot iron. If you ever come near Gloucester, and see the centre tower of its beautiful cathedral, with its four rich pinnacles, rising lightly in the air, you may remember that the wretched Edward II was buried in the old abbey of that ancient city, at 43 years old, after being for 19 years and a half a perfectly incapable king. Chapter XVI. England under Edward III, Roger Mortimer, the Queen at TMS lover, who escaped to France in the last chapter, was far from profiting by the examples he had had of the fate of favourites. Having, through the Queen at TMS influence, come into possession of the estates of the two Despensers, he became extremely proud and ambitious, and sought to be the real ruler of England. The young king, who was crowned at 14 years of age with all the usual solemnities, resolved not to bear this, and soon pursued Mortimer to his ruin. The people themselves were not fond of Mortimer, first, because he was a royal favourite, secondly, because he was supposed to have helped to make a peace with Scotland which now took place, and in virtue of which the young king of TMS sister Joan, only 7 years old, was promised in marriage to David, the son and heir of Robert Bruce, who was only 5 years old. The nobles hated Mortimer because of his pride, riches, and power. They went so far as to take up arms against him, but were obliged to submit. The Earl of Kent, one of those who did so, but who afterwards went over to Mortimer and the Queen, was made an example of in the following cruel manner. He seems to have been anything but a wise old earl, and he was persuaded by the agents of the favourite and the Queen, that poor King Edward II was not really dead, and thus was betrayed into writing letters favouring his rightful claim to the throne. This was made out to be high treason, and he was tried, found guilty, and sentenced to be executed. They took the poor old lord outside the town of Winchester, and they kept him waiting some 3 or 4 hours until they could find somebody to cut off his head. At last, a convict said he would do it, if the government would pardon him in return, and they gave him the pardon, and at one blow he put the Earl of Kent out of his last suspense. While the Queen was in France, she had found a lovely and good young lady, named Philippa, who she thought would make an excellent wife for her son. The young king married this lady, soon after he came to the throne, and her first child, Edward, Prince of Wales, afterwards became celebrated, as we shall presently see, under the famous title of Edward the Black Prince. The young king, thinking the time ripe for the downfall of Mortimer, took counsel with Lord Montacute how he should proceed. A parliament was going to be held at Nottingham, and that lord recommended that the favourite should be seized by night in Nottingham Castle, where he was sure to be. Now, this, like many other things, was more easily said than done, because, to guard against treachery, the great gates of the castle were locked every night, and the great keys were carried upstairs to the Queen, who laid them under her own pillow. But the castle had a governor, and the governor being Lord Montacute Atm's friend, confided to him how he knew of a secret passage underground, hidden from observation by the weeds and brambles with which it was overgrown, and how, through that passage, the conspirators might enter in the dead of the night, and go straight to Mortimer at Atm's room. Accordingly, upon a certain dark night, at midnight, they made their way through this dismal place, startling the rats, and frightening the owls and bats, and came safely to the bottom of the main tower of the castle, where the king met them, and took them up a profoundly dark staircase in a deep silence. They soon heard the voice of Mortimer in council with some friends, and bursting into the room with a sudden noise, took him prisoner. The queen cried out from her bedchamber, "Ao, my sweet son, my dear son, spare my gentle Mortimer." Atm they carried him off, however, and, before the next parliament, accused him of having made differences between the young king and his mother, and of having brought about the death of the Earl of Kent, and even of the late king, for, as you know by this time, when they wanted to get rid of a man in those old days, they were not very particular of what they accused him. Mortimer was found guilty of all this, and was sentenced to be hanged at Tyburn. The king shut his mother up in genteel confinement, where she passed the rest of her life, and now he became king in earnest. The first effort he made was to conquer Scotland. The English lords who had lands in Scotland, finding that their rights were not respected under the late peace, made war on their own account, choosing for their general, Edward, the son of John Balliol, who made such a vigorous fight, that in less than 2 months he won the whole Scottish kingdom. He was joined, when thus triumphant, by the king and parliament, and he and the king in person besieged the Scottish forces in Berwick. The whole Scottish army coming to the assistance of their countrymen, such a furious battle ensued, that 30,000 men are said to have been killed in it. Balliol was then crowned King of Scotland, doing homage to the King of England, but little came of his successes after all, for the Scottish men rose against him, within no very long time, and David Bruce came back within 10 years and took his kingdom. France was a far richer country than Scotland, and the king had a much greater mind to conquer it. So, he let Scotland alone, and pretended that he had a claim to the French throne in right of his mother. He had, in reality, no claim at all, but that mattered little in those times. He brought over to his cause many little princes and sovereigns, and even courted the alliance of the people of Flanders, a busy, working community, who had very small respect for kings, and whose head man was a brewer. With such forces as he raised by these means, Edward invaded France, but he did little by that, except run into debt in carrying on the war to the extent of £300,000. The next year he did better, gaining a great sea fight in the harbour of Sluys. This success, however, was very short-lived, for the Flemings took fright at the siege of St. Omer and ran away, leaving their weapons and baggage behind them. Philip, the French king, coming up with his army, and Edward being very anxious to decide the war, proposed to settle the difference by single combat with him, or by a fight of 100 knights on each side. The French king said, he thanked him, but being very well as he was, he would rather not. So, after some skirmishing and talking, a short peace was made. It was soon broken by King Edward at Tms favoring the cause of John, Earl of Montford, a French nobleman, who asserted a claim of his own against the French king, and offered to do homage to England for the crown of France, if he could obtain it through England at Tms help. This French lord, himself, was soon defeated by the French king at Tms son, and shut up in a tower in Paris, but his wife, a courageous and beautiful woman, who is said to have had the courage of a man, and the heart of a lion, assembled the people of Brittany, where she then was, and, showing them her infant son, made many pathetic entreaties to them not to desert her and their young lord. They took fire at this appeal, and rallied round her in the strong castle of Hennebon. Here she was not only besieged without by the French under Charles de Blois, but was endangered within by a dreary old bishop, who was always representing to the people what horrors they must undergo if they were faithful, first from famine, and afterwards from fire and sword. But this noble lady, whose heart never failed her, encouraged her soldiers by her own example, went from post to post like a great general, even mounted on horseback fully armed, and, issuing from the castle by a bypath, fell upon the French camp, set fire to the tents, and threw the whole force into disorder. This done, she got safely back to Hennebon again, and was received with loud shouts of joy by the defenders of the castle, who had given her up for lost. As they were now very short of provisions, however, and as they could not dine off enthusiasm, and as the old bishop was always saying, "Eh, I told you what it would come to," atm they began to lose heart, and to talk of yielding the castle up. The brave countess retiring to an upper room and looking with great grief out to sea, where she expected relief from England, saw, at this very time, the English ships in the distance, and was relieved and rescued. Sir Walter Manning, the English commander, so admired her courage, that, being come into the castle with the English knights, and having made a feast there, he assaulted the French by way of desert, and beat them off triumphantly. Then he and the knights came back to the castle with great joy, and the countess, who had watched them from a high tower, thanked them with all her heart, and kissed them every one. This noble lady distinguished herself afterwards in a sea fight with the French off Guernsey, when she was on her way to England to ask for more troops. Her great spirit roused another lady, the wife of another French lord, whom the French king very barbarously murdered, to distinguish herself scarcely less. The time was fast coming, however, when Edward, Prince of Wales, was to be the great star of this French and English war. It was in the month of July, in the year 1346, when the king embarked at Southampton for France, with an army of about 30,000 men in all, attended by the Prince of Wales and by several of the chief nobles. He landed at La Hogue in Normandy, and, burning and destroying as he went, according to custom, advanced up the left bank of the River Seine, and fired the small towns even close to Paris, but, being watched from the right bank of the river by the French king and all his army, it came to this at last, that Edward found himself, on Saturday the 26th of August, 1346, on a rising ground behind the little French village of Crecy, face to face with the French king of Tms force. And, although the French king had an enormous army in number more than eight times he there resolved to beat him or be beaten. The young prince, assisted by the Earl of Oxford and the Earl of Warwick, led the first division of the English army, two other great earls led the second, and the king, the third. When the morning dawned, the king received the sacrament, and heard prayers, and then, mounted on horseback with a white wand in his hand, rode from company to company, and rank to rank, cheering and encouraging both officers and men. Then the whole army breakfasted, each man sitting on the ground where he had stood, and then they remained quietly on the ground with their weapons ready. Up came the French king with all his great force. It was dark and angry weather, there was an eclipse of the sun, there was a thunderstorm, accompanied with tremendous rain. The frightened birds flew screaming above the soldiers' TM heads.